Hello and welcome to this podcast of supplementary material for Macbeth in Monaghan.
When shall we free meet again? In thunder, lightning or in rain?
Go, get him, Sir Jemima!
God save the king!
The victory fell on us!
What he hath lost, noble Macbeth hath won!
Look, what I have, show me!
Hark!
Speak,
Macbeth!
Macbeth!
Hark!
That shalt be king hereafter.
Stay, you imperfect speakers, tell me more.
Beware the thing of the fight.
What? Can the devil speak true?
Oh. Look to the lady.
Come, you spirits, attend on mortal thoughts.
Duncan comes here tonight.
Thanks.
Bring forth men, children. This is a sorry sight.
Macbeth does murder sleep. Macbeth shall sleep no more.
A little water clears us of this need.
Wake Duncan with thy knocking. I want that corn.
Horror!
To make them kings, the seed of Banquo kings! Which of you have done this?
Murder and treason!
Over the four programmes of Macbeth in Monaghan, Alan Stanford outlined his five cycles or sections for the play. But he also told us that Macbeth is a drama with no subplot.
There's no subplot at all in Macbeth. It moves at an incredible pace. There is no, Shakespeare always had very strange rules about time in his plays, and there always seems to be two sort of time factors in the plays. Real time, the amount of time it takes for things to happen, and the time that you're in any particular moment. He never worries too much. The only play of his where time is absolutely absolute is Romeo and Juliet, where he's literally telling you what time of which day it is. But in all the other plays, time doesn't seem to be a factor. He just wants to progress both the story and the theme. And in this play, he wants to keep it so pure that he doesn't bother with a subplot. He doesn't set up any character that... very often, like in Lear, you'll have the story of Lear, the story of the Gloucesters, and one counterbalances the other. So you're examining very much the same issues from different perspectives. The betrayal of Lear by his daughters, the betrayal of Gloucester by his son. In Macbeth, it's so absolute, so direct, so complete, and so centred on its hero that it doesn't need a subplot.
My name is Siobhan Harty, and I'm a six-year student at Castletroy College in Limerick. My favourite quotation from Macbeth is, "But in these cases, we still have judgment here, that we but teach bloody instructions, which being taught, return to plague the inventor. This even-handed justice commends the ingredients of our poison chalice to our own lips." These lines are spoken by Macbeth in his soliloquy in Act 1, Scene 7, in which he vacillates over whether or not to kill King Duncan. This is my favourite quotation from the play because it reveals Macbeth's awareness of the certainty that every deed will have a relative consequence and that justice will be done. The poison chalice metaphor is a very effective paradox. We associate the chalice with the wine of the Christian Eucharist, which is perceived to bestow spiritual well-being and love on the recipient. The poison therein suggests the opposite effect. One can imagine the evil and malice diffusing throughout the victim, destroying all love, goodness and life. This is a self-fulfilling prophecy, as it is undeniably borne out later in the play when we see a Macbeth who is after usurping the throne and ruthlessly killing friends and families. He is completely alone. He has lost all his friends, he is despised by everyone, his wife is dead, and despite all his efforts to fulfil his desires, he has ultimately remained dissatisfied. The fact that he dies at the end of the play, having predicted all this, adds powerfully to the play's tragic and dramatic appeal.
My name is Daniel O'Driscoll, and I'm a student at Greendale Community School. My favourite quote is from Act 5, Scene 3. I have lived long enough. My way of life is fallen into the sere. The yellow leaf, and that which should accompany old age, as honour, love, obedience, troops of friends, I must not look to have, but in their stead, curses, not loud but deep, mouth honour, breath, which the poor heart would fain deny, and dare not. I like this quote because it is heartbreakingly sad. Even though I feel Macbeth deserves all he gets, I feel sorry for him because he seems to have recovered some of his dignity, strength and courage, which would have marked him out as a candidate for king in the beginning of the play. He recognises the truth about himself and acknowledges that he alone is responsible for his own downfall, that his evil deeds have cut him off from all he values. I admire the way he confronts his destiny, consequently dying bravely in battle, rather than running away or committing suicide.
My name is Claire McElhaney from St. Louis Secondary School, Carrickmacross.
My favourite scene in the play Macbeth is Act 3, Scene 4, the banquet scene. This is a fantastically tense scene, and it marks the high point in the play as regards Macbeth. Here he is seen to have achieved his ambition, to become king and have absolute power. We also see a significant change in the character of Macbeth in this important scene. In the beginning of the scene, Macbeth is portrayed as a relaxed king, cruel still, but undoubtedly in possession of a conscience. However, as the scene progresses, Macbeth undergoes a metamorphosis into an unscrupulous tyrant. We also observe a rapid degeneration in the sanity of Macbeth. When the scene opens, Macbeth plays his part perfectly as the honourable host, greeting his guests warmly. At first and last, the hearty welcome. However, his mood soon alters as he learns of Fleance's escape from the murderer. But he manages to compose himself as Lady Macbeth upbraids him for neglecting his guests. He then remarks on Banquo's absence. Here had we now our country's honour roofed, were the greatest person of our Banquo present. Subsequently, the ghost of Banquo makes a sudden appearance and sits in Macbeth's place at the table. This is ironic, as the witch's prophecy told that Banquo's descendants would be kings. The appearance of the ghost of Banquo could be interpreted as a real apparition, or as Macbeth's subconscious playing tricks on him, reminding him of the heinous murder of Banquo, for which Macbeth himself is to blame. Macbeth, on seeing Banquo's ghost, and oblivious to his guests, proclaims, "Thou canst not say I did it, never shake thy gory locks at me." Lady Macbeth tries to excuse her husband's strange behaviour to the lords, and fortunately for Macbeth, the ghost vanishes. Macbeth himself then attempts to explain to his guests that he has a strange infirmity, and he begs them not to muse at him. My favourite part of this scene is when the ghost of Banquo appears for the second time. This is my favourite part because I find it amusing that Macbeth brings it upon himself by mentioning Banquo's name, and in doing so, tempting fate. I drink to the general joy of the whole table and to our dear friend Banquo. This time Macbeth shouts and curses at the apparition in an almost demented fashion. This must have seemed very strange to his guests, as they couldn't see the ghost. Lady Macbeth is forced to ask the lords to leave. Undoubtedly, the majority of these lords have now become suspicious of Macbeth. After their departure, we witness a change come over Macbeth. He becomes very suspicious and desperate. We learn that he has servants in his employ in the houses of all the lords in order to spy on them. Macbeth also becomes resolute and confident. He plans to visit the three witches again. "More shall they speak," he proclaims firmly. At the end of this scene, Macbeth realises that he has committed so many evil deeds that there is no going back for him. "I am in blood steeped in so far that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as gore." However, we discern now that Macbeth doesn't really want to turn back, as we see him plan even more atrocious actions. Here Macbeth has completely abandoned his sense of reason, as he decides to commit the strange things that he speaks of before his mind can even mull them over. Macbeth has now reached rock bottom as regards his morals. The scene ends on a foreboding note. "We are yet but young indeed," he announces. This is perhaps a sinister hint as to the deplorable sequence of events that are yet to come. In conclusion, I would like to say that the banquet scene is my favourite scene in this play for many reasons. The gripping tension throughout renders it a very thrilling scene. This scene illuminates the fact that Lady Macbeth, in her role as the catalyst, is quickly becoming expendable.
her role is vital in the beginning of the scene, as she strives to save her husband from exposure. My lord is often thus, and hath been from his youth. Yet as the scene progresses and Macbeth's character changes dramatically, we see that Lady Macbeth is no longer required. Lady Macbeth becomes superfluous. It is fascinating to note in this scene how even though Macbeth has apparently reached the pinnacle of his ambition, he cannot manage to maintain his position. The appearance of the ghost shatters his triumph and marks the beginning of his rapid decline. It is also most interesting to see Macbeth's transition in this scene from a man of some conscience to a completely unethical tyrant. We are yet but young indeed. For Macbeth, the worst is yet to come.
Hello, my name is Stephen Slattery and I'm an English teacher at St. Fintan's High School in Sutton. These are some remarks regarding the theme of kingship and how it is handled by Shakespeare in the play Macbeth. The treatment of the theme of kingship in the play is an important one. Shakespeare was writing the play for a contemporary audience who had witnessed much conflict and change occur in their monarchy in the previous century or so. He presents us with a play in which we see very different men sit on the throne in both Scotland and England. First and foremost, Macbeth is a play about power. Who has it, who wants it, who gets it, who keeps it. The play takes the notion of kings and kingship as a starting point around which to present differing versions of the right to and the use of power. The play concerns four kings: Duncan, Macbeth, Malcolm, and Edward the Confessor. Shakespeare is concerned with contrasting the execution of the kingly office of three of these against the eponymous monarch. The four kings and their own particular brand of kingship can be compared under the following categories: their attitude to their country, to their subjects, to the political climate of the play, and their personalities. Firstly, Duncan is presented as a benevolent monarch. Plausibly, he is the best of the four kings in the play, but then, as in now, the body politic can create well-loved and well-meaning good leaders, but this does not mean they are infallible. He is viewed as a good king. He is a father to two sons. He cares for Scotland and his subjects, and this is reciprocated, sometimes even overdone, as he comments in Act 1, Scene 6. He is called a sainted king by Macduff in Act 4, Scene 3. His reign is presented as having nurtured strong military loyalties, such as represented in the bleeding captain of Act 1, Scene 2, fighting against mercenaries. Macbeth, too, early on in the play, says that the service and the loyalty to Duncan is sufficient for his reward. Macbeth says later in Act 1, Scene 7, that Duncan, quote, hath borne his faculties so meek, hath been so clear in his great office. He has honoured Macbeth, and at this point of the play, it is solely this, the essence of his good kingship, which is causing him doubts regarding the regicide. Doubts he raises with Lady Macbeth, who has herself received the bounty of Duncan's kindness, a large diamond, for her role as hostess at Inverness. On the political front, he is decisive in the manner in which he treats traitors. Cawdor is executed swiftly. However, Duncan could also be viewed as naive. His inability to identify treasonous thanes in both Cawdor and later in Glamis, Macbeth, is a major fault. His comment that there's no art to find the mind's construction in the face reveals a lot about his shortcomings in dealing with certain aspects of his rule, which, at the time the play was set, would have been essential. In Act 4, Scene 3, Malcolm lists off the king-becoming graces as justice, verity, temperance, stableness, lowliness, patience, courage, etc. Macduff says in response that a king without such characteristics does not deserve to live. It is essential to the play that the kingly triumvirate of Duncan, Malcolm and Edward is in stark contrast to Macbeth's rule. What the audience see regarding Duncan, Malcolm and Edmund is very much at odds with Macbeth. Malcolm takes after his father in many ways. He desires a stable Scotland, free from the evil tyranny of Macbeth or of invaders. He rewards his subjects in the final scene of the play by creating earls, similar to the rewarding by Duncan of Macbeth in Act 1, Scene 2. Malcolm has a dark side, however. He lies to Macduff in Act 4, deceiving him into thinking that he is lustful, greedy, even worse than Macbeth, and will run Scotland into the mire should he ascend to the throne. Though he does this to test Macduff's loyalty, indeed it could be argued he's learning from his father's mistakes, one cannot help but question the personality of one who demonstrates the potential for outright and very, as far as Macduff is concerned, believable lying. Malcolm's ascension to the throne in the final scene of the play is often regarded as clumsy and overtly convenient. Macduff fulfills his role as Macbeth's nemesis and kills him, yet Malcolm gets the throne. Donal Bain has not assisted his brother in the attack on Dunsinane and is merely glanced over in the latter stages of the play. Malcolm barely refers to him. What does this tell us about Malcolm's loyalty to the monarchy? However, these are subtleties in the play, because the main issue of the play regarding kingship regards the rule of Macbeth. Though the play is more overtly concerned with loyalty, honour, betrayal, the use of regicide as a catalyst for the demise of a once loyal, brave warrior thane into a paranoid, delusional, selfish king is well handled by Shakespeare. It is clear Macbeth's rule is purely devoted to promoting and nurturing his own agenda. In contrast to the list read out by Malcolm in Act 4, Macbeth knows he is unworthy that honour, love, obedience, friends, in old age he must not look to have. These are irrelevant to him. He has more pressing matters to contend with. Knowing the monarchy is not rightly his, knowing there is much plausible suspicion of his good fortune, namely from Banquo, who reveals to the audience he fears that Macbeth did play, quote, most foully for it, and Macduff, who is immediately curious as to the murder of the bodyguards and does not go to Macbeth's coronation, once ascended to the golden round, Macbeth immediately goes about maintaining this very unstable position, this barren sceptre and the fruitless crown he is in possession of. Everything else a king is supposed to be concerned with carrying out, that which his predecessor attempted to do, is now jettisoned. We are told Scotland bleeds under him. New widows howl, new orphans cry on a daily basis. He is called treacherous, devilish, a usurper and a butcher, and his country is referred to by Kate Ness as a sickly wheel. Shakespeare creates an analogy between a sick country in need of healing and a sick monarch perpetrating a malevolent rule. He has spies, a servant feed. In the Fife Castle of Macduff, he fraternises with Banquo's murderers and then sends a third to carry out the instructions because he cannot trust them. Ironically, he is referred to as a great king by the first witch in Act 4, Scene 1, as a final insult to him, putting his trust in the juggling fiends and their double sense. This sums his rule up entirely. Hecate, speaking of his cockiness, says he, quote, bears his hopes above wisdom, grace and fear, the antithesis of Duncan's intended, although not necessarily fulfilled, rule. By the end of the play, Macbeth has not only lost his hold on the crown, but has also alienated and abandoned his wife, ordered the killing of innocent women and children, his best friend, put his trust in the occult, and has been deserted by his thanes. The killing of the family Macduff by the murderers, when Lady Macduff says she hopes her husband is in, quote, no place so unsanctified as such as thou may find him, raises another issue in the play regarding kingship. Macbeth's loyal murderers are seen as unsanctified. Duncan's murder is seen as breaking open, quote, the Lord's anointed temple, most sacrilegious murder. The religious aspect of the play regarding kingship is a very important one. Edward the Confessor is the key king that contrasts sharply with Macbeth in this regard. The doctor says people are healed by his holy touch. He solicits heaven and is full of grace. The Lord, in Act 3, Scene 6, says that he is both pious and holy. His white magic runs in opposition to the witch's black magic, or another way of looking at it, the Holy Trinity that he puts his faith in is in direct opposition to the three witches of his Scottish counterpart's trust. He believes the heart of Scotland can be cured by prayer, but sends 10,000 men to assist Malcolm and Macduff, showing diplomacy and strategy. Though he never actually appears on stage, Shakespeare successfully sets up a polar opposite to Macbeth. In this way, Shakespeare contrasts the various modes of kingship in the play. A combination of political manoeuvring, religious and spiritual belief, the kingly graces as defined and appreciated by loyal subjects, and the optimistic conclusion that those who are not in possession of worth will not be acceptable to their people as kings.
Hi, my name is Deirdre McCarthy from Laurel Hill Secondary School in Limerick. My favourite quote is, "I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out had I so sworn as you." The classic femme fatale character, Lady Macbeth, cleverly preys on her husband's love for her. She manipulates and goads him into committing the sacrilegious deed of regicide. She suggests he is a poor and undutiful husband. In this quote, she employs an extremely stark image. Her powerful and dramatic language vividly displays a deeply crude, austere and frankly disturbing side to her persona. I feel this illustrates her desperate wish to be Queen of Scotland. She effortlessly exploits Macbeth's undying love for her by very shrewdly questioning it. This is an immensely memorable quote. It undoubtedly stands out from the entire play, mainly due to the graphic, explicit language used to create such a haunting, horrific image.
My name is Carol Fitzgerald. I am a student in St. Nesson's Community College in Limerick. My favourite scene in Macbeth is Act 4, Scene 1, the apparition scene. And this scene is Macbeth's final meeting with the witches, and they give him a description of three predictions. He is warned to beware Macduff. They then tell him he will not be killed until Birnam Wood moves to Dunsinane. And the third one is that none of woman born shall harm him. The scene before this is slow, with a lot of conversation between Malcolm and Macduff. And it contrasts with this scene, which is full of the supernatural, suspense and action. After this scene, we are gripped for the rest of the play as we wait and see if the predictions come true.
My name is Stephen Penny. I am a sixth-year student in Castletroy College in Limerick. My favourite quote from Macbeth is, "I have given suck, and now how tender 'tis to love the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out, had I so sworn as you have done to this." This quote is spoken by Lady Macbeth in Act 1, Scene 7. I like this quote because it is such a strong type of emotional blackmail. For example, a mother's first and most powerful instinct is to protect her young. To actually kill her baby because she had simply sworn to do it would require an immense amount of loyalty. Lady Macbeth says this in order to make Macbeth go through with his plan of murdering the king. A few lines previous, he had said the opposite. Lady Macbeth's use of crude and powerful images sway Macbeth into carrying out the deed. Later in the play, Lady Macbeth's quote is proven false. Every time a murderer is required to cover up their foul act, she loses a piece of herself, while on the other hand, Macbeth becomes more and more at ease with killing. Finally, Lady Macbeth takes her own life because she cannot stand the guilt any longer.
My name's Katie Hayden from St. Dominic's High School, Santa Sabina, and my favourite quote from Macbeth is in Act 1, Scene 7. "Was the hope drunk wherein you dressed yourself? Had it slept since, and wakes it now, to look so green and pale at what it did so freely? From this time, such I account thy love." This is one of my favourite quotes because Lady Macbeth spends Act 1, Scene 7 primarily insulting her husband's honour, mainly in an effort to get him to murder Duncan. This quote was a prime example of that. And not only that, "was the hope drunk wherein you dressed yourself," it's an example of the clothing imagery that pops up throughout the play so often. It echoes what her husband said previously, where he says, "golden opinions from all sorts of people, which should be worn now in their newest gloss, not cast aside so soon."
My name is Alan McMartin from St. Louis Secondary School, Carrickmacross. In Macbeth, Lady Macbeth is my favourite character. From the start of the play and throughout it, I am transfixed by her. When we first meet her, she is power-driven and ambitious. She knows what she wants and she knows how to get it, using any force necessary. This is in stark contrast to how women were seen at this time. Women were usually perceived as nurturing, kind and gentle in Shakespearean plays. Lady Macbeth, it is evident, defies all these stereotypes. We see this when she begs evil spirits to consume her, to fill her to the top toe full of direst cruelty. She exhorts these spirits to take away her femininity and all that this embraces, so that she will have the power to carry out her ambition. Unsex me here. Lady Macbeth's control over Macbeth is fascinating. Macbeth is seen as a fearless war hero, but when he vacillates and finally decides to proceed no further in Duncan's murder, she transforms him with a single-mindedness and clarity of purpose worthy of any war veteran. Lady Macbeth takes complete control of the situation and identifies his weak points with military precision, knowing that an accusation of fear and cowardice would be all the more effective when levelled at a soldier's ego. She bombards him with abuse, questioning his masculinity and his commitment to their relationship. "From this time such I account thy love," and "when you durst do it, then you were a man." She then humiliates him by showing him the firmness of her own resolve, using an horrific and gruesome image. I have given suck, and know how tender it is to love the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked the nipple from its boneless gums and dashed the brains out. This shows just how determined Lady Macbeth is to fulfil their ambition. It also serves to emphasise her unconventional role as a woman in Shakespearean times. She would kill a newborn baby, something that is inextricably linked with goodness and kindness if it helped her to attain her goal. We continue to see Lady Macbeth as a character in complete control when she ensures that the murder goes exactly to plan. Macbeth at this point is weak. He hallucinates before the murder. Is this a dagger which I see before me? And after the murder, he is in complete turmoil. He forgets to leave the daggers beside the two guards, instead taking them with him. It is Lady Macbeth who rectifies the situation, returning with the daggers and smearing the guards' faces with blood, incriminating them. Without Lady Macbeth's control over the situation, the plan would have unravelled with disastrous consequences. Although Lady Macbeth is strong at this point, it is also the first time I begin to see the humanity which she had so cleverly suppressed until now. She admits that she could not have committed the murder herself, as King Duncan reminded her too much of her father. We here begin to see some of her human qualities creep back. Had he not resembled my father as he slept, I'd done it. Her advice to Macbeth after the murder: these deeds must not be thought after these ways, so make us mad. This proves to be highly ironic, as shortly after this she gradually descends into insanity. She dwells on the murders and blames herself for helping to create the monster that Macbeth has become. The Thane of Fife had a wife, where is she now? Finally, she commits suicide, paying the ultimate price for denying her femininity and her humanity. Lady Macbeth, in my opinion, is a deeply fascinating character. She elicits my admiration, condemnation, pity and understanding at various stages. This is a clear testimony to the complexity of her character, as she displays different personality traits throughout the play.
Hello, my name is Stephen Slattery, and I'm an English teacher at St. Fintan's High School in Sutton. These are some remarks regarding the theme of kingship and how it is handled by Shakespeare in the play Macbeth. The treatment of the theme of kingship in the play is an important one. Shakespeare was writing the play for a contemporary audience who had witnessed much conflict and change occur in their monarchy in the previous century or so. He presents us with a play in which we see very different men sit on the throne in both Scotland and England. First and foremost, Macbeth is a play about power: who has it, who wants it, who gets it, who keeps it. The play takes the notion of kings and kingship as a starting point around which to present differing versions of the right to and the use of power. The play concerns four kings: Duncan, Macbeth, Malcolm, and Edward the Confessor. Shakespeare is concerned with contrasting the execution of the kingly office of three of these against the eponymous monarch. The four kings and their own particular brand of kingship can be compared under the following categories: their attitude to their country, to their subjects, to the political climate of the play, and their personalities. Firstly, Duncan is presented as a benevolent monarch. Plausibly, he is the best of the four kings in the play, but then, as in now, the body politic can create well-loved and well-meaning good leaders, but this does not mean they are infallible. He is viewed as a good king. He is a father to two sons. He cares for Scotland and his subjects, and this is reciprocated, sometimes even overdone, as he comments in Act 1, Scene 6. He is called a sainted king by Macduff in Act 4, Scene 3. His reign is presented as having nurtured strong military loyalties, such as represented in the bleeding captain of Act 1, Scene 2, fighting against mercenaries. Macbeth, too, early on in the play, says that the service and the loyalty to Duncan is sufficient for his reward. Macbeth says later in Act 1, Scene 7, that Duncan, quote, hath borne his faculties so meek, hath been so clear in his great office. He has honoured Macbeth, and at this point of the play, it is solely this, the essence of his good kingship, which is causing him doubts regarding the regicide, doubts he raises with Lady Macbeth, who has herself received the bounty of Duncan's kindness, a large diamond, for her role as hostess at Inverness. On the political front, he is decisive in the manner in which he treats traitors. Cawdor is executed swiftly. However, Duncan could also be viewed as naive. His inability to identify treasonous Thanes in both Cawdor and later in Glamis, Macbeth, is a major fault. His comment that there's no art to find the mind's construction in the face reveals a lot about his shortcomings in dealing with certain aspects of his rule, which, at the time the play was set, would have been essential. In Act 4, Scene 3, Malcolm lists off the King Becoming Graces as justice, verity, temperance, stableness, lowliness, patience, courage, etc. Macduff says in response that a king without such characteristics does not deserve to live. It is essential to the play that the kingly triumvirate of Duncan, Malcolm and Edward is in stark contrast to Macbeth's rule. What the audience see regarding Duncan, Malcolm and Edmund is very much at odds with Macbeth. Malcolm takes after his father in many ways. He desires a stable Scotland, free from the evil tyranny of Macbeth or of invaders. He rewards his subjects in the final scene of the play by creating earls, similar to the rewarding by Duncan of Macbeth in Act 1, Scene 2. Malcolm has a dark side, however. He lies to Macduff in Act 4, deceiving him into thinking that he is lustful, greedy, even worse than Macbeth, and will run Scotland into the mire should he ascend to the throne. Though he does this to test Macduff's loyalty, indeed it could be argued he's learning from his father's mistakes, one cannot help but question the personality of one who demonstrates the potential for outright and very, as far as Macduff is concerned, believable lying. Malcolm's ascension to the throne in the final scene of the play is often regarded as clumsy and overtly convenient. Macduff fulfills his role as Macbeth's nemesis and kills him, yet Malcolm gets the throne. Donald Bain has not assisted his brother in the attack on Dunsinane and is merely glanced over in the latter stages of the play. Malcolm barely refers to him. What does this tell us about Malcolm's loyalty to the monarchy? However, these are subtleties in the play, because the main issue of the play regarding kingship regards the rule of Macbeth. And though the play is more overtly concerned with loyalty, honour, betrayal, the use of regicide as a catalyst for the demise of a once loyal, brave warrior Thane into a paranoid, delusional, selfish king is well handled by Shakespeare. It is clear Macbeth's rule is purely devoted to promoting and nurturing his own agenda. In contrast to the list read out by Malcolm in Act 4, Macbeth knows he is unworthy, that honour, love, obedience, friends, in old age he must not look to have. These are irrelevant to him, he has more pressing matters to contend with. Knowing the monarchy is not rightly his, knowing there is much plausible suspicion of his good fortune, namely from Banquo, who reveals to the audience he fears that Macbeth did play, quote, most foully for it, and Macduff, who is immediately curious as to the murder of the bodyguards and does not go to Macbeth's coronation, once ascended to the golden round, Macbeth immediately goes about maintaining this very unstable position, this barren sceptre and the fruitless crown he is in possession of. Everything else a king is supposed to be concerned with carrying out, that which his predecessor attempted to do, is now jettisoned. We are told Scotland bleeds under him. New widows howl, new orphans cry on a daily basis. He is called treacherous, devilish, a usurper and a butcher, and his country is referred to by Kate Ness as a sickly wheel. Shakespeare creates an analogy between a sick country in need of healing and a sick monarch perpetrating a malevolent rule. He has spies, a servant feed. In the Fife Castle of Macduff, he fraternises with Banquo's murderers and then sends a third to carry out the instructions because he cannot trust them. Ironically, he is referred to as a great king by the first witch in Act 4, Scene 1, as a final insult to him, putting his trust in the juggling fiends and their double sense. This sums his rule up entirely. Hecate, speaking of his cockiness, says he, quote, bears his hopes above wisdom, grace and fear, the antithesis of Duncan's intended, although not necessarily fulfilled, rule. By the end of the play, Macbeth has not only lost his hold on the crown, but has also alienated and abandoned his wife, ordered the killing of innocent women and children, his best friend, put his trust in the occult, and has been deserted by his Thanes. The killing of the family Macduff by the murderers, when Lady Macduff says she hopes her husband is in, quote, no place so unsanctified as such as thou may find him, raises another issue in the play regarding kingship. Macbeth's loyal murderers are seen as unsanctified. Duncan's murder is seen as breaking open, quote, the Lord's anointed temple, most sacrilegious murder. The religious aspect of the play regarding kingship is a very important one. Edward the Confessor is the key king that contrasts sharply with Macbeth in this regard. The doctor says people are healed by his holy touch. He solicits heaven and is full of grace. The Lord, in Act 3, Scene 6, says that he is both pious and holy. His white magic runs in opposition to the witch's black magic. Or, another way of looking at it, the Holy Trinity that he puts his faith in is in direct opposition to the three witches of his Scottish counterpart's trust. He believes the heart of Scotland can be cured by prayer, but sends 10,000 men to assist Malcolm and Macduff, showing diplomacy and strategy. Though he never actually appears on stage, Shakespeare successfully sets up a polar opposite to Macbeth. In this way, Shakespeare contrasts the various modes of kingship in the play. A combination of political manoeuvring, religious and spiritual belief, the kingly graces as defined and appreciated by loyal subjects, and the optimistic conclusion that those who are not in possession of worth will not be acceptable to their people as kings.
My favourite character in Macbeth is Banquo. Next to Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, he is the most fully developed character. He is an interesting character whose main role seems to be to highlight Macbeth's faults and weaknesses through his own integrity and goodness. Although he is often contrasted with Macbeth, he did show similar attributes to his companion before he was killed. In the beginning of the play, Macbeth and Banquo appear to be equals. They are both fierce warriors serving the king and are both outstanding in battle. However, Duncan congratulates Macbeth tremendously. Banquo is not jealous or self-centred. He shares in Duncan's praises of Macbeth when he says, "Noble Macbeth." It is their reactions to the witch's prophecies which highlights the difference between Macbeth and Banquo. Macbeth is frightened but extremely interested in the witches. On the other hand, Banquo seems unafraid of the witch's arrival and even challenges them to speak. Banquo is open-minded and, as of yet, he is free from any ambitious thoughts. He does not appear to take any interest in or heed of the witches. "Speak then to me, who neither beg nor fear your favours nor your hate." Banquo arrives at Macbeth's castle. He gives a sensitive description of the castle, which suggests that he is untroubled and at peace with his surroundings. Yet, even before the murder of Duncan, we see a change in Banquo. His curiosity is aroused after Macbeth is made the Thane of Cawdor. We learn that he has been having nightmares about the witches. "I dreamt last night of the three weird sisters." However, he does not give in to temptation. Instead, he asks for merciful powers to restrain any evil thoughts. Banquo is eager to remain a man of integrity. Duncan's murder reveals a cruel and callous nature in Macbeth. The king's murder also alters our view of Macbeth. He is aware that Macbeth is responsible for Duncan's murder. "Thou has it now, King Cawdor Glam Saul, as the weird women promised, and I fear thou's placed most foully for it." Banquo does not reveal Macbeth's guilt to anyone. Instead, Banquo tries to stay a good companion to the new king. Banquo begins to perhaps show signs of ambition, as he also has something to gain from the witches. Once again, Banquo shows similar qualities to Macbeth. Banquo does manage to keep his dignity. Perhaps his untimely death prevented him from losing his integrity and from a disgraced end. The nobles were angered at Banquo's death. He is referred to as Valiant Banquo, whereas Macbeth is known as a tyrant. Overall, we see a transition in Banquo, which is cut short by Macbeth. We can only wonder what would have become of Banquo if he had lived. I feel this is what makes Banquo such an interesting character.
My name is Niamh Tobin. I'm a 6-year student in Castletroy College in Limerick. My favourite quote from the play Macbeth is Macbeth's timeless soliloquy: "I've lived long enough. My way of life has fallen into the sear, the yellow leaf, and that which should accompany old age, as honour, love, obedience, troops of friends, I must not look to have." This epitomises Macbeth's dramatic fall from grace. He has gone from a hero to a figure whose sole name blisters our tongues. Macbeth's honest self-evaluation shows just how isolated and alone the once great general has become. This tragic vision is his recognition of his future. He is informing the audience that he fully realises the unalterable wretched life he has generated for himself through his brutal actions. He has chosen this path as a result of his usurpation of the throne. He knows he has no one to turn to for support. Lady Macbeth was a psychological pillar for Macbeth, but he cut himself off from her by excluding her from his future plans. They are estranged from each other. He has been abandoned by all of his army as they join forces with Malcolm. Without psychological or physical support, he is doomed. He now must and does accept the consequences of his tyrannical reign. He knows he is going to die universally despised. Macbeth has now reached the end of his destructive path. I enjoyed these lines in Macbeth the most because I think this soliloquy accomplishes the catharsis of pity and sympathy for our central protagonist.
Hi, my name is Ciara McInerney from Laurel Hill Secondary School in Limerick. The quote I've chosen is, "I'm in blood, stepped in so far that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as goer." This quote is spoken by Macbeth in Act 3, Scene 4. I believe that this quote illustrates effectively the theme of evil in the play Macbeth. In saying this, the character Macbeth is committing himself wholly to evil. Here Macbeth realises that the murders of Duncan and Banquo are irreversible. His mind and soul will never be the same, and his people will never forgive him. He sees no way out. He has fallen into despair, and so decides that his merciless killings will continue. This decision shows that Macbeth has lost all belief in the possibility that he could once again be a noble man. The path to righteousness, he believes, would be just as hard, grueling, and tedious as continuing his evil doings. It shows that Macbeth has become completely hardened by his actions. He has become brutal and reckless. We see in the murder of Macduff's family that follows his complete disregard for human life. Macbeth has become a man devoid of emotion, on a path to eventual self-destruction. The quote gives an astounding image of Macbeth drowning in the sea of blood originating from his own sword.
My name is Stephen DeCourt and I'm a student from St. Nessens Community College in Limerick. And my favourite scene in the play of Macbeth is Act 3, Scene 4, the banquet scene. Macbeth's conscience is starting to bother him. He feels guilty about the death of his friend. Banquo's ghost appears at the table every time Macbeth mentions his name. Macbeth is driven completely crazy. The others at the table have no idea what's happening. He is the only one who sees the ghost. He sees Banquo with blood dripping from his head. This to me is a very powerful display of his guilt. Others at the table start to suspect him as well. The ghost is his guilt coming back to haunt him.
I'm Mark Patrick Hederman from Glenstole Abbey, and I'm talking about the other world and this world in Shakespeare's Macbeth. Practically every civilization, all children, and most of the world we live in, believe that there is another world, and this other world is ambiguously linked to this one, and how you actually deal with that other world is the tragedy or the comedy for most of us. Now, in Shakespeare's day, everybody believed in witches and their powers, and 9 million women were actually slaughtered because people thought they were witches, that they were people who put a hex or a spell on you. How you deal with that other world, that's the problem for Macbeth. And the fact that it was in Scotland, this play, shows that the Celts were people who had a particular connection with the other world. And the day was always foul and fair in which these creatures would appear from the other world. In our 21st century, many people, with Harry Potter, with films like Omen, will be aware that there are many people who do believe that there is a power, that there is some force, that there is another reality beyond the world we live in. So in this particular play, the witches represent that other world, and their way of dealing with Macbeth is a particular way which allows him perfect freedom, which suggests certain prophecies that are going to come true, and this makes him act in a particular way, but doesn't force him, so that he retains his freedom, but is very definitely influenced by them.
My name is Alison Dillon, and I'm from Loretto College in St. Stephen's Green. My favourite scene in the play Macbeth is Lady Macbeth's soliloquy. This occurs after she reads the letter from her husband announcing the king's arrival. Lady Macbeth shows that behind every great man lies a great woman. Lady Macbeth has a very strong influence over her husband. She's elated after reading her husband's letter and is full of eager ambition that he will become king. However, Lady Macbeth is fearful of his apprehension and cowardliness. She says, "He is too full of the milk of human kindness." This will not stop her in her quest to become queen. She calls on the instruments of darkness to fill her from the crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty. She takes the active dominant role in planning the murder. She never thinks twice about it. According to her, it is simply business to be done.
My name is Jenny Critchley. I'm a 6-year student in Castletroy College, Limerick, and my favourite quote is, "Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." This is my favourite quote, as it says so much in so few lines. It is a powerful speech portraying Macbeth's sad philosophy on life. His view of life is that it is a play, nothing more, nothing less. We are poor players, actors upon this stage of life, with nothing expected of us but to strut and fret for our hour, and then merely fade beyond the curtain. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of heartless emotion, merely a facade of sound and fury, but ultimately signifying nothing.
My favourite quote from the play Macbeth is said by Lady Macbeth in the scene where she pretty much goes mad. "The Thane of Fife had a wife. Where is she now? What, will these hands ne'er be clean? No more of that. You mar all with this starting." These lines to me are significant, because this is the point where everything starts to go wrong for Macbeth. Lady Macbeth is a guilt-ridden, babbling wreck, which means that the brain of the operation is gone. Up to now, Macbeth had followed the advice of his wife. It also shows that she has completely lost composure and wants to get out of the situation. In her mind, the blood will not wash from her hands. This subsequently leads to her suicide. She also believes her reign as queen, and indeed her life perhaps, are nearing their end, by referring to the deceased wife of the Thane of Fife. This line also suggests to me that Lady Macbeth has not consented or advised this slaughter of the Macduff family. The Macbeths are no longer a team, and as we learn later, Macbeth is not ready for kingship without the help of his trusty wife.
Hello, my name is Alison Priseman. I'm an English teacher at Mount Temple Comprehensive on the Malahide Road in Dublin. I'm going to offer some guidelines on answering on Macbeth as a comparative text for the vision and viewpoint. The three modes of comparison for this year's comparative study are the general vision and viewpoint, sometimes referred to as the author's vision and viewpoint, the cultural context, and a theme or issue. I'd like to begin by taking a look at the vision and viewpoint, as many students have difficulty with this mode of comparison. Difficulty arises when students do not have a clear working definition of the vision and viewpoint, and so they don't really know what's expected of them when they try to answer on this topic. Students need to know that the term vision and viewpoint refers to the outlook on life which the author communicates to the reader through his or her story. Always begin by asking yourself if the text is ultimately optimistic or pessimistic. What aspects does it concentrate on and why? The focus of attention should be on the overall impact the text has made on you as a reader and how it communicates this. This impact is usually determined by the ending of the story. For instance, if the overall impact of a text you've studied is inspiring and uplifting, you could say it is optimistic in its vision and viewpoint. If, however, a text ends with a depressing outcome, it probably has a dark vision. You must also be aware that a text may have a balance of both outlooks. A text may take a moral standpoint, condemning or supporting certain values. On the other hand, a text may deal with very complex issues and the author's viewpoint may be ambivalent or unresolved. The question I am using is not a past leaving cert question, but an example of the kind of question you might expect. This question asks you to respond to the following statement. The vision and viewpoint is often articulated by or through a central group of characters in a text. So you have to respond to that, and the question comes in two parts. Question A is, compare two of the texts you have read as part of your comparative study in the light of the above statement. Support your answer by reference to the texts in question. Part A is for 40 marks out of 70. For this part of the question, I'm going to discuss Macbeth by William Shakespeare and Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller. Part B will be for the remaining 30 marks. Write a comparative commentary on a third text from your comparative study in the light of your discussion in Part A above. And for this part of the question, I will deal with the film My Left Foot, directed by Jim Sheridan. Starting with A, your first paragraph should address the question and introduce your two texts for study. It should show the examiner that you have a clear understanding of the vision and viewpoint and how it is revealed in the texts for study. Listen to the following introduction. I agree with the above statement. The author of a text offers the reader a certain vision or outlook on life, which is frequently articulated by or through characters. This can be observed in two texts for comparative study, Macbeth by William Shakespeare and Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller. Both plays offer a dark and pessimistic vision of life and human experience. The vision and viewpoint of Macbeth is largely informed by Elizabethan values and the notion of kingship, while Miller's play is deeply critical of modern American values and the failure of the American dream. This would be a good way of starting your essay. You now need to decide what aspects you are going to focus on as you compare and contrast the two plays. You will be rewarded for making plenty of comparative links and for using key moments from the plays to illustrate your points. The following are points which you could focus on. 1. In both Macbeth and Death of a Salesman, we are given a dark and pessimistic view of life and human experience. Both plays end with a terrible sense of loss and futility. However, you should note that as a product of its time, the play Macbeth offers certainties that are not evident in Death of a Salesman. The play Macbeth is informed by a Christian outlook on life, so the audience is assured that good ultimately triumphs over evil, and despite the terrible atrocities and suffering, order is restored and the evil are punished. 2. If you make that point in your essay, you should contrast it with Miller's vision of modern American life. Miller's vision of modern American life questions the myths and illusions of the American dream. Willie Loman's situation offers a bleak vision of American life. Willie is becoming as obsolete as the broken consumer goods that will soon be disposed of. The third point you could make is that as each play is a product of its time, each one offers a different vision of the tragic hero. Macbeth is a man of high rank, destined for greatness, while Miller's tragic hero is not a man of noble birth. Willie Loman is simply a low man. Pay attention to the scene where Linda states that a small man can be just as exhausted as a great man. As a character, she articulates a modern 20th century vision of the tragic hero, which is a direct contrast with Shakespeare's vision. The fourth point you might make is that one vital aspect of the vision and viewpoint of Macbeth is the Elizabethan idea of kingship and the divine right of kings. This is very clearly articulated in the England scene where Malcolm and Macduff meet in secret, so students should pay attention to what is said here about the king becoming graces. The play seems to support and uphold these values. You could then move on to a fifth point, where you could contrast these Elizabethan values with the consumerist values of Miller's society in Death of a Salesman. Miller's play is highly critical of consumerist values and the cutthroat brutality of the business world. Students should examine the confrontation between Howard and Willie as a key moment in the play. You should note that Miller does not demonise successful capitalists or businessmen. His vision, therefore, is realistic and balanced. This can be seen in his portrayal of Charlie, a humane and successful capitalist. Moving on to the sixth point. Ultimately in Macbeth, the final outlook is bleak and nihilistic. Macbeth, who was promised greatness, has lost everything. His final outlook on life, as a tale told by an idiot signifying nothing, is tragic, and this is a vision or viewpoint which remains with the audience. The seventh point, and your final point, is that similarly, Death of a Salesman ends with a terrible sense of loss and futility. Willie Loman's funeral was poorly attended. His death was unnecessary, and his widow Linda has to live with this outcome. The final scene emphasises Linda's pain and contributes to a pessimistic vision of life. In conclusion, for part A, I've outlined some of the points you could make in which you compared two texts from your comparative study and you responded to the view that the vision and viewpoint is often articulated by or through a central group of characters in a text. So question B says, write a comparative commentary on a third text from your comparative study in the light of your discussion in part A above. For this part of the question, I will deal with the film My Left Foot, directed by Jim Sheridan. My Left Foot offers a much more uplifting vision of life than Salesman and Macbeth. Students are expected to make comparative links in this part of the essay also. The following points can be explored. In My Left Foot, the film focuses on the positive effects of love and relationships. It's a much more optimistic, life-affirming text, and it celebrates the strength and support which Christy got from his family. This text portrays love as a very positive force, and Christy Brown's relationship with his mother is based on unconditional love. This can be contrasted with Macbeth's mutually destructive relationship with his wife. In My Left Foot, we see the positive effects of love, while the love between Lady Macbeth and Macbeth is dark and disturbing. Christy Brown's relationship with his mother can also be contrasted with Willie Loman's relationship with Linda, his wife. In both relationships, the characters love each other, but the Loman's marriage is shadowed by lies and secrets, while Christy and his mother are very honest and open with each other. Miller's play shows us that people can hurt and destroy the people they love most, and this could be described as a very pessimistic view of life and relationships. However, in My Left Foot, the director does not pretend that life is fantastic all the time. He shows that Christy Brown's relationship with his father is a difficult one. This father-son relationship can be contrasted with Willie Loman's relationship with Biff and Happy. Now, listen to this extract from a Leaving Cert essay, which compares the two relationships and uses key moments to illustrate some points. Christy's relationship with his father is a difficult one. Unlike Willie and Biff, Mr. Brown underestimated his son's abilities, while Willie Loman filled his son with hot air and notions of superiority. While Willie strove to inspire and motivate his sons, Mr. Brown strove to feed and clothe his children. Willie set himself up as a hero and a role model to his sons and lectured them endlessly about the importance of being well-liked. Mr. Brown, on the other hand, expressed his love in actions rather than words. When Christy wrote Mother on the floor in chalk, Paddy acknowledged Christy as a Brown by bringing him to the pub. The closest he came to saying he loved Christy was when he built a room for him out in the back garden. Yet these simple acts of love were powerful and real, unlike the hero worship and adulation that Willie sought from his sons. The above extract was used to show you how you can compare and contrast what's going on in your two different texts, and also to show how you can briefly refer to some key moments. I used two key moments from My Left Foot to make my point about Mr. Brown and his love for Christy being shown in actions rather than words. Finally, to bring your essay to an end, you could discuss the role of humour in My Left Foot and how this contributes to the optimistic and life-affirming vision and viewpoint of the film. This can be contrasted briefly with Macbeth and Salesman. Your conclusion should refer back to the question itself and should summarise briefly your response to the question.
My name is Kerry Duffy from St. Louis Secondary School, Carcam Cross. The part of the play which I find most compelling is Act 2, Scenes 1 and 2. In the first scene, we see the world of Macbeth has been given over to the power of darkness. Banquo is restless and disturbed. He is plagued by nightmares and struggling with temptations. The tense, foreboding atmosphere is created by the descent of darkness, Banquo's fears and his premonitions of evil. When Macbeth is alone, his true sense of horror at the impending crime manifests itself in the form of a dagger. This hallucination is a sign of his terror and guilt. In his fourth soliloquy of the play, he wrestles with his conscience. In the dark and silent night, he guiltily fears every sound, even his own footsteps. Macbeth is very conscious of what he is about to do. He is mentally prepared for it, but it's his nature that remonstrates the awful deed. I think at this point, he knows that murdering Duncan will not bring him happiness, but despite the protests of his heart, his mind has already succumbed to the temptations of possibility. In an hypnotic state, he murders the king, and in his disconcertment, he removes the daggers of the sedated guards. He is completely demoralised, and when he returns to Lady Macbeth, he is gripped by hysteria and guilt. In this following scene, we see a different side to the fiend-like queen. She appears nervous and vulnerable. We learn that Duncan reminded her of her own father. This sentimental and nostalgic characteristic lends Lady Macbeth a new dimension and sustains our fascination with her. But subsequently, after getting a glimpse of Lady Macbeth's true nature, Shakespeare cleverly plunges us back into the deep torment and remorse of Macbeth. We witness Lady Macbeth slowly regaining her cruel and practical front. While Macbeth broods deeply, with the blood on his hands confirming his constant guilt, she is forced to return the daggers herself. The conversation between them is tense and abrupt. What is very apparent at this point is the strong contrast between Macbeth's helplessness and his wife's triumphant strength. While she faces reality, he's obsessed with horror and his own imaginings. At the end of this scene, the knocking on the door reminds the audience that reality and normality exist outside the castle. It threatens Lady Macbeth with discovery, and for Macbeth, it's like the voice of God demanding retribution. I think this scene is so engaging, not only because of the murder, but the frantic, hysterical and intense atmosphere that's created. The two characters who we followed from the beginning are given a totally new dimension. The plot develops dramatically, and Shakespeare's fascination with human nature somehow transfers onto us, the readers. The inconsistency in both Macbeth and Lady Macbeth is intriguing, and from this point we observe the gradual and tragic destruction and division of two remarkable characters.
My name is Lorcan Blake, and I'm from Belvedere College in Dublin. My favourite quote from the play Macbeth is, "I have begun to plant thee, and will labour to make thee full of growing." King Duncan gives us this metaphor of planting while speaking to Macbeth in Act 1, Scene 4. I like this quotation because of its relevance to the character of Macbeth. King Duncan has given him the opportunity to prosper, having appointed him to the positions of both Thane of Cawdor and Thane of Glamis. King Duncan has also shown his commitment to the cause by declaring that he will accompany Macbeth until he is indeed full of growing. Two things strike me about this extract. Firstly, it is clear that King Duncan has complete confidence in Macbeth. As we will later see, this is pure naivety on King Duncan's part, as Macbeth swiftly turns into a tyrant. Secondly, I admire the fact that this metaphor does not simply stand alone, as it is followed by a corresponding quote from Macbeth. He says, "There if I grow, the harvest is your own." I find this to be a truly ironic response, as later on in the play, Macbeth's growth is of absolutely no benefit to King Duncan.
My name is Cathy Fitzgerald, and I'm a sixth-year student in Loretto College, Stephen's Green. I'll be talking about my favourite scene from Macbeth, and it's the banquet scene. Because Macbeth initially welcomes the guests to the banquet. He's happy to hear the news of Banquo's death, but then his terror returns when he's told about Fleance's escape. At the banquet table, he's confronted by the ghost of Banquo, which is sitting in his place. And it is ironic that Banquo has returned, even though he is a ghost now. Because before he went riding, Macbeth said to him, "Fail not our feast." And then Banquo replied, "My lord, I will not." Banquo kept his word and he did return to the feast. There is a dramatic irony because the audience is aware that Banquo has been murdered, but the numerous guests at the banquet don't know. And all they see is Macbeth shouting and talking. They don't understand why he's hallucinating. They are mystified at Macbeth's apparent loss of mind. There is also tremendous suspense created because Lady Macbeth is terrified that Macbeth will give away their evil deed, and Macbeth is petrified at the sight of Banquo's ghost. The ghost has such an impact on Macbeth that he acts feeble and weak as the ghost undermines his manlyhood. This scene is of great importance to the play as Macbeth is at his political peak in his kingship, but this scene also marks the beginning of his downfall. Because after the scene, things start to go wrong. Lady Macbeth tries to cover up, saying he's not well, and privately rebukes him for his revealing behaviour. Macbeth completely then loses his composure and he points at the ghost and orders it to leave. Lady Macbeth fears that Macbeth will reveal vital information if he is questioned by the ghost. So for the second time, she rebukes his behaviour and she bids the guests good night as politely as possible. He is then determined to go and meet the Weird Sisters to foresee his future.
My name is Gerard Griffin from Loretto College, Stephen's Green. The theme that I want to cover today is that of kingship. There are four kings that we need to think about. Duncan, Macbeth, Edward and Malcolm. Duncan, firstly, represents order, loyalty and goodness. The sanctity of kingship and the natural fertility which he manifests is clearly the way Scotland should be ruled at the start of the play. However, there are many notable flaws in Duncan's character, as he does seem somewhat ineffective as a king. When we first meet Duncan, he is not with his army but awaits a report from the bleeding sergeant on the outcome of the battle. He has been unable to control his kingdom in the first place due to his overly trustworthy nature. He has trusted the wrong person once, i.e. the Thane of Corridor, and admits there is no art to find the mind's construction in the face. Yet he goes on to do the exact same thing again, trusting Macbeth. Macbeth makes a very important statement about the nature of Duncan's kingship. He says, Duncan hath borne his faculties so meek, had been so clear in his great office, that his virtues will plead trumpet-tongued against the deep damnation of his taking off. Through this statement, or admission from Macbeth, we learn that Duncan exercised his power with a mixture of humility and greatness. Macbeth thus identifies Duncan with divine law and understands instinctively that the murder would be sacrilegious. Moving on to Macbeth's term of kingship after he commits the murder, we can clearly see that he sends the natural order that Duncan had represented into free fall. He immediately has difficulty in pronouncing the word amen, which conveys the distance that now looms between God and the king. Macbeth consequently cannot sleep because of the murder. As he says, Macbeth had murdered sleep. He ironically describes the murder as a breach in nature. A conversation between Ross and an old man who represents the ordinary people of Scotland also heightens the effect of Duncan's murder and Macbeth's unlawful reign. Ross declares that darkness does the face of the earth entomb, which portrays a bleak picture of life in Scotland after the kingship has been usurped. An even more frightening aspect of this breach in nature is the story that the old man relates of an owl killing a hawk and Duncan's horses eating one another. Macbeth is totally dependent at this point on the instruments of darkness to sustain his kingship. We know that he cannot last as he is not the rightful heir. He is prepared to have the whole world fall asunder to keep himself in power. Macbeth is also as credulous as his predecessor in many ways, as he believes the witches when they say, none of woman born can harm Macbeth. He also trusts in them when they say that he shall never vanquish be until great Birnam Wood to high Dunsinane Hill shall come against him. To which he sarcastically mocks, who can command the forest? The answer to that question, as we know, is God himself, through the English and Scottish forces directed by Duncan's son, the rightful heir, Malcolm. The kingship of England is also in stark contrast to Scotland. King Edward is described as a sanctified king, who Malcolm and Macduff ally themselves to. He is able to cure diseases called the evil. Whereas Edward is seen as a healer, Macbeth is seen as a disease. Edward has the gift of prophecy, while Macbeth depends on the equivocation of the fiend that lies like truth. Shakespeare does not need to labour the point to make us believe that Edward has been placed on the throne by God and that England is a sanctified place with such a ruler as he. We accept his obvious bias. It simply accentuates the point that Macbeth is a usurper. Scotland a living hell, England by contrast, a utopian paradise. Finally, Malcolm. Malcolm shows us that he is not only entitled to the kingship of Scotland, but he will be a better ruler than his father. He shows us wisdom beyond his years in evading his seemingly noble compatriots in seeking sanctuary in England. He tells his brother not to consort with them and that there's warrant in that theft. Malcolm's quick decision-making at this point is an indication that he will eventually be a great king of Scotland, especially, as Shakespeare would have us believe, under the tutelage of his mentor, Edward. When Malcolm and Macduff meet in England, Malcolm voices his suspicions of Macduff as he asks him, "Why in rawness left you wife and child?" Malcolm then questions Macduff to test his loyalty in relation to Duncan's family, and indeed the loyalty that he has in regards his own country. Malcolm does this by threatening to destroy law and order in Scotland, to pour the sweet milk of concord into hell. He also states testingly that he himself will make Macbeth seem as pure as snow. Malcolm shows us at this point that he will be more apprehensive in who he appoints as his thanes in future. He will not judge by appearances as his father did. Malcolm also illustrates how skillful a soldier he is in comparison to his father, as he leads from the front as opposed to the back. He orders his army to camouflage themselves so as to surprise the enemy in terms of numbers. He is confident and optimistic and clearly directs Siward and his son in battle. At the end, Malcolm reassumes the kingship that his father lost. He is the rightful heir to the throne. Therefore, the natural order is resurrected under his kingship. He recalls the exiled friends from home, and it is clear how much he has learned from his English mentor since his sojourn there. His first act on coming to power is to declare, "My thanes and kinsmen, henceforth be earls, the first that Scotland ever named."
The production team for Macbeth and Monaghan was Kevin Reynolds, Catherine Brennan, Sean Rocks and Orla Cotter, with Tony Lyons on sound. You can access the original four programmes in the series, as well as further supplementary material, at rte.ie/radio1/podcasts. You can contact the programme by email on drama@rte.ie, or you can write to us at Macbeth and Monaghan, the Drama Department, RTE Radio 1, Donnybrook, Dublin 4. RTE Drama would like to thank the staff and pupils of St. Louis Secondary School in Carrickmacross, Monaghan Collegiate School, Patrician High School in Carrickmacross, and St. McCartan's College in Monaghan. We'd also like to express our thanks to Inver College in Carrickmacross, Loretto College, Stephen's Green, Belvedere College, SJ, and Wesley College in Ballantyre. Greendale Community School in Kilbarrick, St. Fintan's CBS and Dominican College, Santa Sabina, both in Sutton, and St. Nessens Community College, Laurel Hill Secondary School, Castletroy College and CBS Sexton Street, all in Limerick. All of those schools, teachers and staff who gave so generously of their time and expertise to us.